This recording is of a Maynooth Sociology Society meeting on pro-choice struggles in Ireland, recorded in April 2009. It features three activists who were involved from the early 1980s to the current day in these struggles. You can download more audio files from www.wsm.ie.
Tonight, the title of today's event is The Changing Irish Society, the Irish Feminist Movement and the Fight for Safe and Legal Abortion Services. The intention of the discussion is to chart the gains made by feminist activism over the last three decades in the fight for reproductive justice. It was through public pressure and brave action from the Irish Women's Liberation Movement and through the direct provision of groups such as the Contraceptive Action Programme and the Irish Family Planning Association that contraception was finally legalised in Ireland. However, abortion is still illegal, and approximately 20 women a day continue to travel overseas for abortion services. It is only since a referendum in 1992 that Irish women even have the right to travel to other countries to have abortions. It remains an offence under Irish law to attempt an abortion in Ireland with a maximum of life imprisonment. And so the fight continues for women to claim fundamental rights over their own bodies. As birth control activist Margaret Sanger declared, "No woman can call herself free. She does not have control over her own body. No woman can call herself free until she can choose consciously whether she will or will not be a mother." Sociologist Dr. Mary Murphy, who's here with us tonight, will be talking about her activism in the Women's Information Network, the 1980s Abortion Information Helpline. Andrew Flo here will be giving us an account of pro-choice activism since the 1990s.
I'm going to cover the gap between.
And Sinead Hearn will be talking about her involvement with Choice Ireland.
Yeah, first of all, I'm not here as a sociologist, okay? Make that really clear. Because, I mean, I suppose if I was, I would have been a lot more evidence, we were discussing earlier on. I'm here primarily because I met Hilary at a sociology event a while ago. We were just chatting about Choice Ireland and what's going on at the moment. And I was just telling her that I was a member of Women's Information Network in the late 1980s and early 1990s. When we were an underground illegal telephone helpline giving information, advice and support to women who were seeking abortions in England. And it's on foot of that Hilary asked me to come here. It's not really on foot of anything to do with my direct work in the Department of Sociology. So I suppose in terms of, like, given that I'm starting off, what I thought would be most useful is, don't want to get too much into the legal history and stuff like that, because it's known to some degree. But I thought the more interesting story in some degrees was the women's story, both from the point of view of women's political activism and the women who set up the line and their feminist approach to working together, but also the women who use the line and their story of having to try and procure abortions in incredibly secretive and very, very difficult situation politically in the late 1980s. And they are the two stories that I thought maybe are the ones that don't get told in that whole story. But I suppose starting off, I mean, abortion had always been illegal in the context of the 1861 Offences Against the State Act, which would have been old United Kingdom legislation. When Britain legalised for abortion in 1967 with the British Abortion Act, for one, they excluded Northern Ireland from that act, and two, unlike other pieces of legislation, which often Ireland did follow in a path-dependent kind of fashion after the UK, in this particular incident we didn't, and we could see very clearly what the politics were emerging in relation to the unlikely pulled off Ireland actually adopting any progressive abortion legislation. So when Spook began to lobby in the early 1980s for an amendment to the Irish Constitution which would copper fasten the illegality of abortion in Ireland, they got in 1983 the first of what was to be a series of three referendums on abortion, the Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution, which did copper fasten the illegality of abortion in Ireland, but didn't particularly at the time, people thought, risk the illegality of information given about abortion in Ireland. So from 1983, when that referendum passed, most of the organisations, like the Students' Unions, the Well Woman, the Irish Family Planning Association, the Open Line Counselling Service, most of them still operated above ground, openly, publicly giving out abortion information. Until around 88, when SPUC began to get very, very active using legal challenges to challenge the legality of giving information and advice and support services around abortion. And in 1989, in the Hamilton Supreme Court judgment, they won, basically. There was a legal finding that the organisations, student unions, women's health clinics, that were giving out abortion information were illegal, and they were ordered to stop doing that. And the immediate impact of that, for anybody who wasn't around at the time, was it was absolutely mental. I mean, it was ridiculous. It was McCarthyism at its most extreme. Dublin City Council took books out of the libraries that had abortion information in them. The Guardian newspaper was impounded in Dublin Airport because it had abortion information. Most of the British magazines that were selling into the Irish market, like Cosmopolitan, you know, those kind of magazines, did out Irish editions with no abortion information in them. It was extremely draconian reaction, and a lot of media self-censorship that probably went far beyond what was necessary at the time. And obviously the legal injunctions that were on students' unions and the Well-Woman and that stopped their provision fairly immediately. So it was in that context that the Women's Information Network got set up, a very hysterical, political, incredibly threatening environment for women seeking abortions, with a lot of media airplay that was really derogatory about women's rights, about women's bodies, about who owned them, and women's own voices finding it very difficult to find a place in that debate. Primarily for a lot of women activists who felt so strongly about the issue that they found it very difficult to emotionally articulate where they were politically in the debate or be public in the debate, because the strength of feeling around the issue was so strong, and they felt so individually and personally pilloried by people who were anti-abortion at the time. So the WIN information helpline got set up around the late 88, early 89, and the phone number was 679-4700. And I don't know if anybody remembers at the time, it was a really well-known chant around Dublin, and I was just thinking of the child there, because lots of kids in buggies when we go on marches and things, all the kids used to say, 679-4700, women have the right to know. That was the chant going along, and for years, kids were shouting it out in the most inappropriate places, and quite cracked, like trying to stop them. So for the women who set it up, I suppose most of them came together through the campaigns that were on at the time around, you know, political campaigns against the Supreme Court decision to stop information legality. The decision to set up the helpline happened fairly organically in some degrees, like it was an idea that was coming its way, and it was kept fairly quiet to some degree at the beginning because there was a real hysteria about the SPUC agenda getting in on it, about infiltration, about being stopped, about being arrested, about being imprisoned. There was a very real sense that what was being done was so political an act that it would have been reacted against by the state quite heavily, because SPUC would have put great pressure on at the time. So the women that formed it, some of them knew each other in a loose way through other political campaigning. Some of them didn't know each other, but most knew. So there was a sort of snowballing kind of effect where most would have known each other at least by word of mouth to somebody else at the beginning. Later on, it began to open up a little bit more to a wider group of women. The women were as diverse as you can imagine, ranging from, I remember one was a swimming instructor, there were teachers, there was health board workers, there was unemployed women, there were students, a couple of women worked in the media, one worked in RTE, so a very, very wide range of women. None of them were prepared to put any public name to WIN, so it was a very undercover decision by them personally to get into it. Most were motivated just by direct political activism. I mean, usually it was an immediate response to a blockage of information that women needed. And most were, I suppose, practicing feminists, I suppose would be the best way to put it. Most were already, you know, had a very clear commitment to feminism in their own personal lives. And I think some who had a less maybe developed commitment to feminism certainly developed it over the course of being on the helpline. And although there wasn't a very overt political philosophy around the feminism, you know, different people would have different strands of it, but the way it started working almost immediately was an almost collective cooperative style of organisation with no hierarchy at all. And it didn't, there was a bit of discussion about working like that, but it didn't require a lot of discussion. It was a natural choice for most of the women involved. So for things like, I mean, there was no committee set up for that. It was, you met once a month to set up a rota for when the helpline would be done. People rotated secretarial functions, people rotated money-related functions, people rotated minding the keys of the place. Some people, you know, so everybody, there was 8 or 9 jobs that had to be done each month, and they were just organically rotated with everybody taking their turn. So it was actually a really interesting experience in working like that in a very organic way, in terms of the personalist political, and I suppose the sociological theory would be that new social movements try and, you know, change the way the world is by adopting their own different values and practice about living out those new values. And certainly it was, I think, a real genuine experience, something like that. Finding a premises was always really, really difficult, because organisations, obviously, there was the practical thing at the time that this was recessions, 80 Dublin, you know, even phone lines weren't that common. We were very lucky in the end, after a couple of hatched attempts at using people's houses and using back rooms in people's offices, that the old DRC, the Dublin Resource Co-op on Crow Street, gave us a little space. And when I say little space, that desk wouldn't have physically fitted into the room that the helpline operated from. It was a triangular room at a difficult corner of a building that somebody just literally put a door literally across to make the room. And it was just a little hatch with the phone in a secure box that you could lock, and a small little sort of boxy thing to keep the information in again locked. So it was incredibly primitive in that sense. It was next door to a hairdresser's, and one of the big practical issues that we had at the beginning was stopping people who were getting their hair cut hearing some of the phone lines going and the answering machine going on the phone line. So it was really practically a very flimsy operation in terms of what the resources that were available to it. And I must say that the women in the Dublin Resource Co-op, very few of them were actively on the line itself, but they were absolutely incredible in that they had to stay out to, you know, to lock up the premises after we'd used it every night. So their own practical commitment to enabling the line to happen from their premises, they took a huge risk from their premises, because it could have been raided at any time. It was all their jobs, you know, their livelihood at stake. There was about 30 jobs in the co-op at the time. But then just their own practical time commitment was really impressive as well. So the line went on Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursday evenings from 7 to 9, and then on Saturday mornings. The information about the line went out through every imaginable possible way. I mean, we chanted on marches, stickers on bicycles, T-shirts were made. The most common way was going around GPs' offices in a fairly, like a network of people, where you would post out the stickers about the line to as many, you know, villages, towns, cities that you could. And women in each individual town agreeing to try and sticker GPs' offices or health board offices or places where they thought women might conceivably be keeping an eye out for any information, or it might be, you know, at-risk situations. The railings around the Well Women's Centre, for example, were always heavily stickered with the phone numbers on it. Pub loo doors were always heavily stickered. And it was sort of a pastime on a Friday night to go out with, you know, a bunch of stickers in your jeans pocket and, you know, just bang them up wherever you happen to be and that type of thing. And a lot of people just did it as a matter of course after a while. And it, in terms of usage, I suppose, the line, at its zenith, probably it was getting probably about 30 phone calls a week, direct phone calls for women who were looking for information. The fundraising was done, and you'd probably talk a little bit about this. There was an abortion information campaign set up to support the information campaigns in both Dublin and Cork, and the fundraising for the line came primarily through, at the beginning, just, you know, your normal pub quizzes and book collections at marches and things like that. As the line got a bit more structured and a bit more secure, we began to get some funding in kind from some of the British pregnancy agencies in the guise of money for training or money to train ourselves in counselling, that we then sort of pushed towards, you know, other kinds of needs that we had. And that link with the British abortion clinics was really, really important, in that we were very conscious that what we were doing as an interface between women who were very vulnerable and in such a secretive kind of environment that we needed to be well trained in not, we didn't say we were offering non-directed pregnancy counselling at any stage, but we knew often that we would be the only person that that woman spoke to ever, because there was a history at the time that the women were so fearful of being found out about going for abortions that they would not go to the counselling that was available when they got to Britain for the abortion. That there was a pre-counselling service available to the pregnancy to agencies in Britain, but Irish women had a very consistent record of not turning up. So the advice and information they could get from us was often the only conversation they might have had with somebody about it. So we got the British Pregnancy Advisory Service to come over to Dublin for a couple of weekends in the early days of the helpline, and we all got trained. And then every year a couple of us went over for about a week to their professional training courses, got ourselves trained, and then went back and did our own training with other people back in Dublin. So there was a fairly good relationship between the Pregnancy Advisory Services, and we were also managed to negotiate a sort of a block reduction almost for every 10 women we referred, that we could get a free termination. And that proved absolutely essential, because the reality for a lot of the women who were phoning the helpline was that the trauma, the immediacy of their problem, but money was one of the biggest issues in Dublin in the 1980s and early 1990s. Like, unemployment was nearly 20%. There was just no money anywhere. You couldn't borrow from people. You couldn't tell anybody. Women were trying to get the money in secret. So a lot of the support on the sides of the helpline was often, pub quizzes, ringing around people looking for €20 rounds off, or £20 at the time, to try and help women. They might have been able to get £200 together, but they needed to get £450, which at the time was huge amount of money. So a lot of the practical work was actually very practical support. Women, for example, in rural areas who had the problem that it might have taken them, because this was pre-Ryanair as well, so a lot of women had to get the boat because they could never afford an early flight at the time. So it meant that they were likely maybe to be away from their town or wherever it was, their job, and certainly from their family for 3 nights. So explaining that kind of absence for women, particularly from rural Ireland, or older women who maybe had children already, and women in domestic violence situations, young teenage girls whose parents might not, you can imagine. So a lot of the practical advice and support was almost talking through those options for women, as well as the option of the termination to begin with, and the practical advice around the termination. So it was almost like a double kind of whammy. Not only had it to go through that whole secrecy of the information blockage and deal with that, but then they also had a really heavily practical obstacle in their way of how to get to Britain with no money and the time and the secrecy aspect of it going on. So it was usually fairly busy, like each phone call might have taken to quarters of an hour. So the 30 calls a week probably meant that you might pick up 5 or 6 on an answer machine, you'd phone them back, and then on the 2 hour slot each evening you might pick up another 2 or 3 each of those evenings. There was a lot of referrals from GPs, from social workers, but a lot of professional health workers knew of the service, used the service and supported the service, and that was important as well. Another aspect that I always thought was really important was there was a London Irish Women's Support Group, there was a London Irish Women's Group, and they set up an abortion support group as a result of just their own experiences of friends of mine went over and the practical help and support they had to give them. And they were brilliant, like they would meet women off the boat, off the train in Paddington, they'd put them up in their houses for the night before, they'd help with money, and just the emotional support that they could give women as well. So as a feminist collective, it was a fantastic experience that way, I suppose, of self-help, of very empowered women taking the situation into their own hands and deciding that this isn't going to happen the way the state's planning for it to happen, and that there was another way of organising it. For the women on the helpline as well, I suppose, quite a few women went through quite a difficult time at certain stages on it, working through the issue of abortion itself. And the one thing that always struck us when we were getting the training from the British Pregnancy Advice Services was that the culture of abortion in Britain and the background to it and the history of it was so socially and politically different to it in Ireland, and I suppose the Catholic nature of Irish education was so different to the British public education system, and that we had always felt that the nature of the counselling in Britain, the nature of the advice and support that Irish women were getting, probably wasn't as appropriate as had it been homegrown to meet the particular needs of Irish women, because a lot were very, even though they were very, very clear even about their choice, because for many it wasn't a choice, it was the only option that they could see, but for a lot of them they were incredibly tormented about their choice, just because of the context and their own history in which they made it. So they had very difficult times sometimes around that choice, and it was just a very, very difficult situation for a lot of the women. In some situations we ended up having to, on the request of either partners or parents of children, and sometimes at the request of social workers, one of the services that we ended up doing that we never ever anticipated was actually going with women for abortion, so actually going physically to bring them with them, in circumstances where they were either very emotionally vulnerable or maybe learning difficulties or were very young or were just very, very, very scared and simply couldn't practically have made the journey alone. And that happened two or three times even, where families got the money together to pay for somebody from them to go with the person at the person's request. So the kind of work that opened up moved far beyond information into a much wider range of it. And I suppose towards the end, I mean, I know Andrew's going to talk about this, but after 92, when the, you know, the right to information was affirmed in the 92 referendum, there was a lot of discussion at the time in Wales about, you know, should it shut? There was always an information helpline. Campaign had been won, you know, it could start to be legal again. But it was felt, because of what we knew about the support needs of women going, that there was actually a really valid need to stay open, not so much as an information line anymore, but as a support line. And then there was an awareness too that even though information was readily available in the larger cities probably, that there were still incredible difficulties for women in more isolated situations accessing information. So it stayed open a good 8 years after the right to information became legal again. And it closed with, and we brought that as this was its closing call. It launched a book that's in that photograph I just passed around, because I suppose, and this is where being a sociologist comes in, I suppose, and we were just talking about this, is that prior to the internet and digital cameras, that we had no physical record, because everything was illegal, you know, there was no reason to keep everything, all the documents were always destroyed, we never kept people's personal notes about anything, so there was very little to show for 10 years of an underground helpline that actually had been very powerful, and had actually, you know, worked through with thousands of women. So we commissioned, we wrote a book ourselves and got a bit of funding to get it printed up, and launched it as our farewell party. But I couldn't find any copies of the book for a long time. As I said to Hilary, in fact, they are around. I phoned somebody today, and she has a few. So one of the lessons, I suppose, from that period would have been that, you know, we didn't, as a feminist collective or as an abortion campaign, keep any record of what we were doing. And I'm really sorry about that now. There's no photograph of the helpline. There's no photograph of the stickers, of the T-shirts, of even, there may be a T-shirts actually, we may see some of the pronouns on T-shirts, but, you know, we didn't think consciously of recording our memories at the time, which is a pity now. But also, we didn't record the women's stories in any systematic way. We have a couple recorded in that book, just as a flavour, but there was very rich evidence that we had that we didn't record, and that would have been a really important part of Irish social history, feminist history, women's history. We could have reported. So if we were doing something again, I think we'd be more conscious of that need. The women just went their separate ways now, and one of the reasons I was delighted to meet up with Hilary again is that I was asking a couple of women I phoned, because I asked them to come in to do this instead of me tonight, and none of us, none of us that I phoned and that we knew of through the network of friendships that we'd have with each other still, none of us seem to be involved in any of the pro-choice campaigns that are going on at the moment. And it did seem to me that there is some kind of generational relinking that needs to be done there around people who are very active in the 80s and 90s campaigns, and, you know, who are still very committed to the issue, but just in their personal lives have just moved on to other things. And maybe that reconnection could be, you know, something that we might achieve out of this sociology tonight. Okay, so I'll leave it at that, because we can ask questions later on.
So I have the same problem with images and stuff. I mean, nowadays on a digital camera I take 200 pictures of every event I go to, so I have loads, but I very few back then. and the first thing I wanted to do was try and put some context on it, because sometimes it's kind of hard to understand how much Ireland has changed. So I was looking through my photo archive, couldn't really find anything suitable, and at the end I went into this. So this is me in what was Czechoslovakia, I think around 1989, and I was interviewing with Aileen, who was the person who was meant to be giving the talk tonight, and we were so fascinated by the fact that you had a condom vending machine on the street that we had to have a picture taken of it, so that's me posing beside the machine. In the south, in order to buy condoms, you had to be married and you had to have a doctor's prescription. Abortion was, and still is, illegal. There was no divorce. Sex between men remained illegal at that time as well. Most of those things have changed, but not the abortion thing. So, in terms of context, that's a starting point. Things were obviously changing, and there was an awareness things were going to change on both sides of the equation. In 1980, a small women's right to choose campaign had been set up, and in the following year, the pro-life amendments campaign had formed. Now, that was interesting because abortion was illegal at the time, but they were aware these changes were happening, so they wanted to make sure it stayed illegal. And what they wanted was the referendum that happened in 1983, and that they successfully won by about two-thirds to one-third in terms of votes. And my teenage years were, you know, I was in school at the time, but I was following all this sort of stuff, so they were very sort of formed by that. 4 months after that referendum, Anne Lovett, a 15-year-old girl, died giving birth alone in an outdoor grotto in Granard. And this is the only image I could find on the internet. But it kind of brings home the kind of human cause to what was happening at the time, the kind of complete denial in Irish society that was happening. In 1984, Aileen Flynn was sacked from her teaching job in Ugross Convent for having a baby outside marriage. So again, that was the sort of society that existed. And then in the later 1980s, SPUC, Society for the Protection of the Unborn Child, moved to try and close down any source of information whatsoever. And I can skip a bit there because that's already been covered. I turned 18 in 1986. That year there was a general election which was accompanied by a referendum on divorce, and that referendum was lost by a ratio of 2-1. So it's not terribly surprising that a lot of people going through that whole period of defeat by quite strong percentages in what was quite a bad time ended up being quite demoralised by that whole experience. I went to college in the late 1980s, and in the end of the 1980s, SPUC moved against any of the sources of information, including the National Students Union, USI, and the Students Unions in UCD and Trinity College. They all had referendums in which the students had voted to defy High Court injunctions and to continue to give details of abortion services and their welfare guidebooks. That actually didn't consist of much more than the number. The student leaders, the people who'd been elected to office, were taken before the High Court. Didn't end up with any of them being jailed for contempt, but they were held personally liable for a course which totaled about £60,000 back then. Now, again, to give that a bit of context, you could have bought two houses for £60,000 then. But in a way, Scott had made a bit of a miscalculation on this, because essentially the climate before this is pro-choice campaigners had more or less retreated from the streets. But going after the student unions in this manner meant that dozens of young people started to get involved for the first time. So this is one of the pickets outside the High Court when these cases are underway. And that's the second one in the same event. Again, very few photographs from this actual period. There's one or two familiar faces in there. I think that's Ivana Bashik, for instance. Just up there. She was one of the people taken to court. And after the student court cases, the Cork and Dublin Abortion Information Campaign was set up. I was involved in the Dublin one. And I don't have any pictures of T-shirts, but I do have one photograph of the demonstration outside the door. So yeah, I mean, what we were doing was we were taking the telephone numbers 679 4700 and we were putting that out in a very public way. And part of what we were trying to do was actually invite prosecution, because we kind of looked at what had happened around the student union cases, where Spock had gone after the student unions, and we said, well, that didn't really work out for them, because it actually started to generate public anger around us. So the basic strategy we were following was to give out the number, mostly down at the GPO. We used to give it out leaflets, do events like this, invite prosecution. We kind of hoped if they prosecuted us, that would be something you'd then build a campaign around. Spock had also learned the lessons from the kind of Pyrrhic victory they had during the student cases. They won it, but it wasn't that useful to them, and very wisely didn't actually go after us. But what it did mean was that most Saturdays, over a period of 2 or 3 years, there was a few of us down at the GPO leafleting. And that turned out to be valuable when on February 6, 1992, the news about the X case broke. Now, the specifics of the X case are probably generally known, I don't need to explain this, but basically a 14-year-old girl became pregnant as a result of rape, she was called X to protect from the court, hence the X case. Her parents brought her to England for an abortion, and while they were there, they phoned the guards back here and asked what DNA evidence the clinic should retain for a possible prosecution of the rape case, and instead they were told to return home immediately. The Attorney General at the time had obtained an injunction on the basis of the Eighth Amendment of the passed in 1983, and the High Court then ruled that the girl was prohibited from leaving Ireland, quote, for a period of 9 months from the date thereof. So essentially she was interned. We were leafleting at the GPO that Saturday, and as I said, we'd been doing that for a while, but what was different about it this time was that literally every second or third person stopped and, you know, started talking to us about how angry they were. Now, if you've ever done any street leafleting, that's a pretty unusual situation. Normally people are quite disinterested. So in the pub afterwards, we decided something was happening and we should try and do something around it. So we called Picket Up the Doll for Monday, that was intended just to be a press stunt, and we called a rally at the GPO for the following Saturday. And we called it as a rally because we reckoned if less than 100 people turned up, you know, we could just have a meeting and that would be fine. As it happens, the Irish Times advertised the Monday lunchtime demonstration, and hundreds of people turned up, maybe as many as 1,000. Like, it was, you know, considering we were probably expecting 10 or 15, it was kind of a mind-blowing crowd. Also considering that, I mean, all of us were very young, with no real experience of organising stuff at any size whatsoever. We were quite freaked out, because we were thinking, oh my God, this is much bigger than we thought it was going to be. It became quite clear Saturday would be really big, and probably somewhere between 10,000 and 15,000 people turned out. We love arguing about the numbers. The other thing that was happening was not only were the numbers quite big, but in terms of the slogans people were chanting and stuff, it was much more militant than it had been in the 1980s, with placards, leaflets and chants insisting on a right to choose, and you know, not just on a more limited basis. Faced with growing anger, the government took the unprecedented step of offering to pay the costs of an appeal to the Supreme Court, which enabled Miss X to travel to England. And in doing so, the Supreme Court interpreted the Constitution in a new way and changed Irish law. It decreed that abortion was lawful in Ireland in the event of there being, quote, a real and substantial risk to the life as distinct from the health of the mother, as in the case, which included the case of threatened suicide. Now, that's significant because that's remained the actual legal situation despite repeated attempts by the anti-choice people to overturn it. In the aftermath of that, the Repeal the Eighth Amendment campaign was formed. It collapsed ahead of the November 1992 referendum on the tax bill differences. The other thing that happened was, in terms of, I think that's another picture from the X case period, in terms of the anti-choice movement, was now they were quite demoralised. They mobilised, but it was obvious they lost, in particular, the kind of urban young crowd that they might have previously had support of, and over time they could tell they were going to lose it. So one of the things that happened was an organisation called Youth Defence, where it was set up on Father Michael Cleary's 98FM radio show. And they were interested in another aspect as well, because previously the kind of anti-choice movements had been quite respectable. Like, you know, they tended to be people that were quite well plugged into society, were well behaved, were very successful at lobbying. I mean, nasty stuff that happened during the 83 campaign, but in the mainstream, you know, they had access to power, they used it that way. The approach of Youth Defence was rather different, particularly in the initial period. For instance, death threats were phoned into Radio Dublin when they wouldn't carry interviews with youth defence members. There was an incident on Thomas Street when pro-choice campaigners were attacked with pickaxe handles and snooker cues, resulting in some people getting broken bones, including a friend of mine. Youth defence marches were stewarded by a large number of the pipe goons, the knuckles wrapped. And there was a famous Irish Times picture from that period, one of the first ones, where they'd literally got like 40 guys at the front of the march with, you know, the knuckles done up. When hard press ran an expose on youth defence, the editor Niall Stokes had a concrete block thrown through the back window of his car. Part of that story was repeated physical confrontations with pro-choice campaigners on the streets in this period, including an attack with hurley sticks on a private pro-choice meeting in Buzzwell's Hotel, just across the road from Double Aaron. Our main response to this was whenever youth defence marched, there were counter-demonstrations held, and when they attacked us, we held larger demonstrations the following week, but this time we organised larger numbers of stewards to help protect us. Over time, youth defence gave up the physical attacks and essentially left us to continue leafleting at the GPO. In late 1992, November, a referendum was held in the aftermath of the X case, and essentially this was the... Well, it did two things. One is it was going to clear up the issue of the right to travel and information. But the third thing it tried to do was it tried to overturn this idea of abortion being legal in Ireland on the grounds of a threat of suicide. And that was the 12th Amendment. There were three separate amendments. That was the 12th one, which was at the time referred to as the substantive issue. And this proposed that prohibitions on abortion would apply even in cases where the mother was suicidal. Now, one of the significant things about the 92 campaign, and it was a measure of the actual change that was happening, was that two of the unions, the ATGWU and SIPTU, ran a joint campaign calling for a yes, yes, no vote. That basically was the kind of pro-choice position. It was yes to travel, yes to information, but no to this attempt to introduce the added restriction. The Irish Congress of Trade Unions released press statements opposing government wording on abortion and produced over 150,000 leaflets arguing their case. So, you know, for the first time, you actually began to get quite large movements being willing to come out and publicly start taking a position that would be identified with the pro-choice side. The pro-life groups, so anti-choice groups at the time, were calling for a no-no yes vote across it. Basically, they didn't want the information, they didn't want the travel, but they did want this closing of the possibility of suicide being a reason. But in fact, the way the electorate voted was that yes, yes, no, that the pro-choice organisations were advocating. And in fact, a follow-up poll on the Sunday Independent in February 2003 showed that something like 74% of those who were aged between 18 and 34 thought the Eighth Amendment, that's the one passed in 1983, should be scrapped. So part of the big story that's happening in these years is a huge change in public attitudes from 1983 to 1992 and also towards today. The change that meant that in 1995, a very restricted divorce referendum was actually won just by a few thousand votes, but in comparison with the 1986 votes, that was quite a significant move forward. So the next significant thing I'm going to talk about happened in 2001, and that was Women on Waves. This was a Dutch-based group of doctors, nurses and women's rights activists who hired a ship and installed a medical facility and came to Dublin. The Dublin Abortion Rights Group, which was previously been the Dublin Abortion Information Campaign, but we changed their name after the kind of victory in the 1992 referendum, and the Cork Women's Right to Choose group invited the abortion ship, in quotes, to visit Ireland. And the idea was that they'd moor outside the 3-mile limit and provide abortions for Irish women. Now, we'd essentially seen this as a precedent, you know, something that would generate publicity. We didn't really think any women would come forward to avail of this. But in fact, in the couple of weeks before that, the ship arrived, over 300 women contacted us. And this is an astonishing number graphically illustrated how many women in crisis pregnancies had huge difficulties raising money to travel abroad. However, due to lack of preparation on the Dutch end, no abortions were actually carried out. But the other significant thing was that the mobilisation by the anti-choice people was actually really, really minor. You know, we'd expected all sorts of chaos. Like, we basically expected there were going to be riots on the quays, and we planned for that eventuality, but it never came out. For the pro-choice side, on the other hand, it meant putting the abortion rights discussion back on the agenda. There were 10 days of, you know, pro-choice articles in the media. there were demonstrations, that was in Temple Bar. There was also the very visible way that was demonstrated that the ban was affecting working class women in particular, and that the anti-choice crowd had been treated. 2002 saw yet another referendum, yet another attempt to, you know, roll back that suicide question. One of the interesting aspects of that referendum is that the anti-choice side actually split during it. Ah, yes, so here we go. So between the more kind of hardline elements and the softer crowd of going, well, you know, we want to try and get a bit more of a ban than we have, so we're willing to compromise on this. And I think it was probably mostly the youth defence who argued the other way. So if you're wondering around Dublin in this period, you saw this kind of confusing mixture of posters, you know, what way are we meant to go on that? Again, though, they kind of felt the more hardline anti-choice side was defeated on it. The main organisation on the no side of the alliance were No Vote, which actually ran on a very limited budget, about €15,000 or so. The actual vote was very close, about 10,500 votes in the difference, and just so that's about 50.4% against 49.5%. And one of the things that came out of this referendum, and it's become very visible, was that there was a very strong urban-rural divide, and also a very strong divide in terms of age groups. I mean, it was a Fianna Fáil proposal, and it was significant that the areas that this thing that was rejected by included those of Bertie Ahern and Health Minister Michael Martin. So that brings us on to kind of the modern era. I'm going to throw up two photos. I won't say anything because I'm seeing Sinead Thunder.
I think it's actually really interesting that Andrew put up those photos. The last photo that Andrew put up, I couldn't figure out if that was a protest that I'd been at or a protest from the years before me. Sometimes it can get a bit confusing because a lot has changed, but unfortunately a lot has stayed the same. I'll start a little bit with the history of Choice Ireland. Things on the pro-choice front were actually quite quiet between 2002 and 2007. Not a huge amount happened. Completely out of the blue, Labour Youth decided to organise a meeting on pro-choice issues. It was in the aftermath of a very large internal debate within the Labour Party on policy on abortion. So they set up this public meeting. Once again, there was people leafleting on the issue of abortion outside the GPO, which hadn't happened in a huge period of time, apart from Youth Defence, who were there every Friday. The meeting actually ended up attracting a massively diverse range of people, from people who were just interested in feminism to people who just were interested in this particular issue. In the open meeting, one of the workshops they had was one on direct action. So looking at the idea of how we could come together and take direct action, quite similar to what was done by WIN to help women who were actually facing the need to travel at the time. And one person of that workshop brought to our attention the issue of road crisis pregnancy agencies. Road crisis pregnancy agencies are essentially agencies that tend to be pro-choice. They will put advertisements in places like the Golden Pages. They'll call themselves things like A Choice for Women, the British Alternative Pregnancy Service, Ask Magella. Their ads will often talk about things like pregnancy counselling, ultrasound scans. They'll often intimate that they have links to clinics in England, so that you'll often see things like Dublin, Bristol, London. So if you're flicking through the Golden Pages and you're in a crisis pregnancy, you're going to really be drawn to these people. Myself and a number of other activists within the group, we identified one of these agencies, A Choice for Women, which was at the time operating on 50 Dorset Street. We strapped table recorders to one leg, a vial of the urine of a pregnant woman to the other. Not my proudest moment, as I said before, and in we went to try and find out what these people were like for ourselves. I'll just tell you a little bit about my own experience. I sat down and explained that I thought I was about 5 weeks pregnant and I was very, very worried. that I was in quite a dodgy situation. They showed me a video of a termination. They handed me a little plastic fetus that was sucking his thumb and had eyelashes, and told me and demonstrated the abortion procedure with a pen. They then told me that were I to have an abortion, that I would end up with a number of very nasty side effects, a mixture of promiscuity and frigidity, which worried me, sighing, huge mental health consequences, and that I'd probably go on to, if I didn't become infertile or die as a result of the procedure, I'd probably go on to abuse any future children that I have. Needless to say, I went in there knowing what I was getting into, and I was quite upset. The group at this stage, after we'd pulled out of the undercover operation, we'd expanded quite a bit, and we decided to give ourselves a name, Choice Ireland. And we decided that we really wanted to mobilise against these agencies, so we began holding a series of protests outside the WRC. Our first one was on International Women's Day, 2007, so that's 2 and a bit years ago now. There we are. What's interesting about rogue agencies is that when the Abortion Information Act was passed, the passing on of abortion information is actually quite strictly regulated in this country in some ways. If you are giving abortion information, you have to be a recognised crisis pregnancy counselling agency. If you're saying that you're not, if you're not passing on phone numbers at clinics, you can actually more or less do whatever you want. Why this is interesting is that the behaviour of the rogue agencies that we're targeting, it's actually not illegal. Explicitly. They are giving false medical information, which is unethical, but the actual activity is not illegal. These agencies are not regulated, so they can't be shut down. So what Choice Ireland is trying to do at the moment is make submissions to the Office Joint Committee on Health and Children to bring in legislation so that anyone providing abortion information or crisis pregnancy, well, more so crisis pregnancy counselling, has to be very strictly regulated, so that they're not able to tell lies. One of the things that we, one of the biggest things we've done around the rogue agencies is last summer we held a month of action where we literally stood outside the agency every single Saturday for a month so that they couldn't entice any more women in there. There we are again. while that was our focus for a very long time, I remember one evening, it was late April 2007, and RAG, the Anarcho Feminist Group, were holding a video evening, and we were all watching the abortion diaries. So a group of pro-choice activists were all together in Chambers Free, which is a collective social space at the time on Ormond Quay, when one of us got a text message saying that a young 17-year-old girl who was pregnant with an asymptomatic pregnancy, so a pregnancy where the brain didn't develop, was being blocked from leaving the country to have a termination. I can't tell you what the atmosphere was like. Immediately, a number of pro-choice groups mobilised and we organised rallies and support outside the forecourt. Misty was in court 8 days. In all, we're outside every single day. I think what's quite poignant about all of it is that we've won a huge amount of gains in terms of information, but it's quite stark to see the parallels between the protests that Andrew talked about in the 90s, people standing talking outside the GPO because another girl has been interned, and also outside the forecourt supporting that woman. In this case, though, the judge managed to completely skirt the issue and just pointed out that just because she was 17, she shouldn't be blocked from travelling, and she was let go. But he didn't really address the issue of her right to have termination here, which she should have. We've tried to keep a dialogue going about abortion in Ireland. One of the unfortunate things is that a lot of the time the issue gets gets left by the wayside unless something is happening, unless there is a case like Miss D, like Miss X, unless there is a tragic story to tell like that. So last summer we set up Don't Send Your Packing, which is an installation outside the office where we just put 20 suitcases outside the door, and we can see the little tags there. They're all pictures and little stories of women, just to highlight the 20 women who still travel every day. And we also held a rally outside the Central Bank around the same time. So that's kind of some of the activity of Choice Ireland. We want to talk a little bit about where we are. Huge amounts have happened since the days when we didn't have condoms and since the days when people were being brought to the High Court for passing on the numbers of abortion clinics. Why hasn't anything changed legally in terms of abortion? It's a largely non-discussed issue. And a very small right wing in Ireland seems to have huge stranglehold on what's going on. A few events from last year, I think, really kind of crystallised that for me. And Amnesty International came out with a pro-choice stance. The Irish chapter was actually forced to step back from that because a number of churches threatened to ask their congregation to withdraw their membership from Amnesty International. And the reaction that happened in the north was Amnesty International were banned from schools in Northern Ireland. So Amnesty here stepped back from that campaign. The government as well seemed very reticent to deal with the issue. The Miss D case that I talked about, it happened just 5 weeks before our last general election in 2007. Abortion still wasn't an issue that politicians discussed. The only mention of abortion throughout the whole general election, despite the fact that this landmark case was electrifying the country, was Enda Kenny assuring the Catholic newspaper that Fine Gael would not legislate for X were they to be brought into power. A study that was carried out by the IFPA looking at female TDs' views on the issue found that most female TDs just felt that it wasn't on their radar, that they weren't able to do it, they weren't able to bring it up for fear of losing votes. Or I think as Alwyn Enright put it very nicely on Questions and Answers one night, it's not an issue that's raised on the doorsteps. I rather guess it's not. Another huge issue that faces us is that anti-choice campaigns have an absolutely huge amount of money behind them. Choice Ireland, a lot of our work is done by photocopying things in people's offices. We beg, steal and borrow money from people. All of our time is volunteered. If you compare that to organisations like Youth Defence, who were able to exceed even some of the large government parties' spending on the Lisbon referendum. So they have absolutely massive amounts of money behind them. But the question is, are the small group of people who seem to have such a stranglehold on our NGOs and our politicians and seem to have so much money, are they actually reflecting the views of people? Andrew kind of touched on this a little bit earlier on. There actually is a huge shift in public opinion on the issue. You can see it there from 1988-2003. Number of people who were against abortion in the case of rape massively reduced. Over the nearly 10 years. Today you can see, in exceptional circumstances like D and X, so when a pregnant woman's life is at risk, when the fetus can't survive outside the womb, when the woman's life is in danger, actually the vast majority of people do feel that women should be allowed to have an abortion in Ireland. We're not quite there yet in terms of access to abortion on demand. Still 43%, but you can see there's an absolutely huge change. The poll that was taken in 1988 didn't even ask if people were in favour of abortion on demand, because they didn't think that anyone would even begin to answer that question, I think. So huge amount has kind of changed since then. The future of it really is, in order for anything to change, there needs to be enough public pressure to hold a referendum that will overturn the 1983 Eighth Amendment. The only way this can really happen is if enough pressure is brought to bear on the government, to actually do this. There is some rumblings that change might actually end up coming from Europe. At the moment, there's a number of cases going through the European Court of Human Rights where a number of women are challenging our ban on abortion on the grounds that it's a threat to their right to privacy and their right to decent healthcare by banning them, by preventing them accessing abortion. And the Council of Europe have given us a very stern talking to about it. Unfortunately, Europe doesn't actually have any direct power on the issue, so it really is hard to know whether or not the pressure for a change will be brought to bear internally by people kind of speaking out, or if it will come down from Europe based on cases like this. A third option, and unfortunately I think it's possibly the most likely one, is that whether it be tomorrow, whether it be 5 years, there will be some tragic, tragic young woman. There will be a tragic story. And it will be that will actually get a change, and it's such a pity that that has to happen. So yeah, that's where we are now. Thank you.
This recording is of a Maynooth Sociology Society meeting on pro-choice struggles in Ireland, recorded in April 2009. It features three activists who were involved from the early 1980s to the current day in these struggles. You can download more audio files from www.wsm.ie. You'll be able to listen to the questions and answers session that followed these three talks on that site from about the 30th of April 2009.